This is Mae Warren. Today is the 1st of July, 1996. I'm in Lexington, Virginia with Ward Briggs. And you're class of 1967. I did a little homework on you, not too much. I went and looked at the calyx and saw that you're from Delaware. You're the first person I've talked to from Delaware. What brought a Delaware boy to Washington and Lee? What was the attraction?
I had gone to a camp. We had long had the Southern sympathies, though Delaware was a border state. We chose, our sympathies were Southern. And as a boy, I had packed off to a place called Camp Greenbrier down in Alderson, West Virginia. And it was basically populated by people from Washington, Norfolk, and Richmond. It had originally been a kind of athletic camp for people that athletes who wanted to, they were trying to recruit to the University of Virginia. But, and it was basically people from St. Albans and St. Christopher's and Norfolk Academy. It was run by someone from Norfolk Academy. And so there were just, and there were three groups. There were people who were going to UVA and people who were going to VMI and people who were going to WNL, and that was it. It was not Harvard, Yale, and Princeton, as far as I was concerned. It was those three, and all my friends were choosing between those. And we stopped to visit them 2 years in a row on my way back from the camp. We parked on Washington Street and walked. We said, well, here's a sidewalk. Let's see where it goes. We walked, and it's the moment we turned that curve. We saw the colonnade, and we all just said that it was the most beautiful sight we'd ever seen. It was more beautiful than, Charlottesville, as far as I was concerned. And I came back for the first time since graduation, about 85 or 6, something like that, almost 20 years afterwards, and the same thing happened. Like, I walked up that walk, and I saw it again, and you just absolutely struck by it. It's just such a beautiful sight. So that's what I wanted to do. And I had a couple of friends from Wilmington who actually came down. There was actually a reasonable Wilmington contingent here. So down I came. It was the only place I wanted to go. I'd applied to other places and got into other places, but this is where I wanted to go, and there was a fraternity that I wanted to be in. And when I graduated from high school, my godfather gave me a little keychain with a sort of slab of silver on it, and to put my name and address. And he said, "Well, put down Washington Lee." And I said, "Put down Phi Kappa Psi, Washington Lee, because that's the fraternity I want to get in, and I'll get in or else." And so I got in.
How did you know which fraternity?
Well, that's where a friend of mine had from school, who was 2 years older than me, had gotten into a Phi Psi, and he showed me pictures, and we went by the house, and it's not what it is now. It was a mirror image of the SAE house, and it was just this beautiful white sort of wedding cake house. Completely rotten on the inside, but it looked the part. It was on this big hill, and all the brothers were just very attractive in all ways. I mean, they were great, and I think I just profited enormously from the fraternity system. I was an only child, and had a sort of Victorian parents, so I was always sort of was at sea about what to do, and being sort of serious about life. And all of a sudden, I had 35 older brothers who very carefully sort of took care of you. I mean, they told you when you were doing something stupid. They told you when you were dressing badly, or when you said something that was uncool, or something like that. And I personally needed that greatly. And I think a lot of other people, to varying degrees, needed that as well. And The result is that I think, for me, one result of the fraternity system is that I have just, I can say, I have never met a socially inept Washington Lee person. I mean, they may, you know, may not be, you know, setting the world on fire intellectually or anything, but they know how to behave, and they're decent, honest people. I never knew anybody here who was dishonest, you know, who you just knew was dishonest or would cheat you or anything. I mean, there was just something about this place, and it was reinforced at the fraternity level. Those kinds, there's plenty of sort of debauchery too, but what was that which was supposed to be instilled really was carefully instilled in its integrity and its just this wonderful sense of honor. And I was very fond of them, and I am remain very grateful to the fraternity system as it was then, though it certainly had faults. I like the agreement.
Have you remained friends with your fraternity brothers out in real life?
It's funny, no. I don't see them, and I'd love to. I love them all, and I wonder, you know, really what happened to them and how they're doing, particularly the ones older than me that I just idolized. I don't know. And I don't see that many people from Washington Lee. I mean, that's maybe the problem with one of its virtues, which was academic, which was geographical distribution. You know, we were always told that WNL had the greatest per capita geographic distribution of any school. And it certainly was true. I mean, people came from Montana. I knew people from Montana, South Dakota, all over coming here. So I mean, the result is that I don't see them very much. Most of my fraternity brothers were confined to Short Hills, New Jersey, and that sort of area. But now at least half of them are retired and have been so for a number of years, working their way up from the top of Daddy's brokerage agency or real estate concern. So now they're even more scattered to places like Aspen and Montreux and places like that. So, you know, it'd be even harder to get them together.
Yeah, a lot of people have a leg up before they ever get here. You made an allusion to that the fraternity brothers gave you advice on how to dress. Now, you were here during the time period where something one other person told me about that I'd like to hear more about. You were here at the beginnings of questioning the concept of conventional dress. Do you remember anybody challenging conventional dress when you were here?
The only challenge I remember was one transfer student, somebody who came in, maybe a sophomore or his sophomore junior, who had an earring. And he claimed that he'd been in the Merchant Marine or something and had crossed the equator. And he's allowed to have an earring. But this made him an instant outcast. The dam seems to have burst. I think mine was the last freshman class to wear beanies. I'm not sure. I know we never wore blue jeans, but I think the dam really burst when I left, the 68 and 69. I don't hold myself responsible for the dam bursting, but I think that that's probably when. So I think I really sort of missed that. Fancy dress was a big deal when I came, but I don't ever recall going to fancy dress. I think that was certainly sort of moribund. One of my fraternity brothers had been president of fancy dress. My freshman year, but I didn't go to that. I didn't go that year, and I cannot remember going to fancy dress. I mean, our speaker, who went to UVA, just admitted that he went to more fancy dress balls than I did. His last one was in 62, though. So, yeah, so I don't think I was, I mean, I think we all pretty ungrudgingly wore coats and ties to class. I thought that was okay. And I bought into it. I mean, I really believed that if you took the class seriously enough to dress up for it, you would take it seriously enough to prepare for it. I mean, it meant that serious business was going on. And for some of these teachers, I mean, I wouldn't dream, you know, going to Dr. Laborn's class without a tie. I mean, it was beyond belief. Dr. Jenks, you know, all these people. I mean, Harry Pembrin's class I would go to, a t-shirt maybe, but not just because it was more relaxed. But,
let's talk about those faculty people. Yeah. Who was important to you and why?
Well, I think it's funny because we're here this week talking about General Lee, and there really are a great number of parallels between, I think, General Lee and Dr. Laborn. I mean, in the sense that Laborn really, he was distant and unknowable, yet he was accessible to everyone, took the greatest care with every student. He would, if you missed his class too often, you would get a card. He wouldn't call you, but you would get a card in the mail, a postcard. I notice you have missed my classes. I trust you're not ill. Remember, we have an absence policy. Things like that. He was an interesting, but he was a very interesting lecturer, I thought, and he was, especially now, having been an academic myself for a while, amazing in his ability to return tests. That he would return every paper the next class meeting, very carefully marked, every paper. And when the exams were done, if we had an exam in the morning, he would say, you know, and the exam would be get out at noon, he would say, gentlemen, your grades will be up at 3:30 or 4 or something like this. And at whatever time it was, I mean, he would take all these exams and go in and grade them. And our grades and our exam grades and our final grade would be tallied. And it would be posted on a board, on a kind of a bulletin board on a little stand, and it would be brought out to the front of the library where his office was. And we'd all go out to see what our grades were. I mean, it was just
this
phenomenal.
In less than 24 hours?
In less than 6 hours. I mean, he would do this. There are certain limitations. It meant that he was looking for certain things. It meant that he was looking for certain answers. And these were all essay questions, of course. So, you know, that would be miraculous enough with multiple choice. But these were all essay questions. But there was no doubt when we looked at the exams, we looked at what he'd given us, he very carefully marked these. He not only, on papers, he would not only mark errors of fact, but he was particularly good on infelicities of style or usage, particularly. And I would say, I remember once, and all he had to do was just mark something in the margin, and you never forgot. I mean, I said, this is in this case, Schiller proposes an intriguing question. I have always been intrigued by Schiller's response to this, meaning interested in. And he would say, an intrigue is a mystery that you mean interested in. Bingo. I said, this is a masterful treatment of the Trojan War. And he'd say, masterful means tyrannical, you mean masterly, things like that. Now, I didn't try to make these errors, but I loved getting these, you know, precise comments back from him. I've never forgotten one that he did. And what's more, again, from my academic perspective, all he had to do was say that to me once, you know, point that out once to me or other people, and you never forgot it. I mean, you did. Now I grade papers and I say these same things. I mean, I have a system where I essentially students write basically the same paper three times in a class, just adding to it. And each, you know, I'll correct the same error three times, you know, and still get it back to them. So I think it's his importance. It was just just the aura that he had. And I think that aura really gave the place its zeitgeist. I mean, I think he really was kind of the equivalent of General Lee here, in that he was really what the university was about. He was the one faculty member, I think, who really came up to the dignity of the place. You know? And I remember, I just remember the sort of that distant affection, you know, that we all had for him. You kept it distant, but he was always tremendously interested, and he was enormously sentimental about things. I, in my senior year, I was taking a class in the Roman poet Horace, and so I decided I was going to translate the first book of Horace's odes in their original meter, which were very complicated and not very friendly to English. And I did it, and I had the person who did cartoons for the paper, named Gary Apgar, write up draw-ups and drawings and watercolor. I mean, he did them in pen and ink and then filled them in watercolor for, I don't know, four or five of the poems or something like that. And when I graduated, I went down and gave it to him in his office. And he just started to weep. He just started crying. And he was just so grateful for him. Not, I mean, they weren't any good. They were awful. I mean, sort of embarrassing. But he was just absolutely so touched. It was the only thing I could do to give him back, you know, anything like what I felt he'd given me. And yet that sentimentality led some people to, you know, sort of question whether or not he was really performing rather than, you know, genuinely experiencing these feelings. And in my time, there were two famous lectures, and I heard one of them three times in his ancient history class. Anyway, in the ancient history class, Parents' Weekend, he would do a lecture called Arete, The Pursuit of Excellence. He would start, obviously, with Egypt, or the Garden of Eden, at the beginning of the semester, and so by October or so, he was just starting 5th century Athens, which is where he really felt at home. And, of course, you know, parents would come to this. And he'd start talking about Athens. And it was this beautiful society on a hill, and it's kind of on a foothill in the middle of Achaea. And he said, and it was full of just beautiful, highly intelligent, aristocratic, athletic, golden youths who contended with each other in the arts, in games, athletic contests, in literature, philosophy, constantly striving to achieve excellence in each and every area of interest, as opposed to this sort of barren, joyless, militaristic society over the hill in Sparta, whose services were necessary certainly necessary to keep off the Persians and people like that, but basically not a society that you could be as proud of as you could this fabulous 5th century Athens. Well, it was very clear, and I don't have the skill to do it, but it was very clear he was talking about Athens and Sparta, but he was really talking about WNL and VMI. And it was a bravura performance when I saw it, and and the parents just went ape. I mean, the parents couldn't write their checks fast enough. It was really the only lecture I knew that was attended by the university treasurer. Every time it was given, Mattingly was outside the door of the thing. I remember, because he was a distinctive looking guy, he was outside the door, and the parents were there just handing him the money. I mean, they were just so, I mean, not literally, but they were just so, I mean, this is what it's supposed to be. This is it. I know my parents love it. And that was Parents Weekend, and then at Thanksgiving, we'd be at the end of the 5th century. And this would be the day we were to leave. I mean, it was the day Thanksgiving vacation started. I think it was probably a Wednesday, maybe a Tuesday, I can't remember, but probably a Wednesday. And it was at 10 or so in the morning, something like that. And nobody ever thought of cutting that class. I mean, there was just no possible way. I mean, now our Thanksgiving vacation starts on Tuesday, and students, the previous Friday are wishing me a happy holiday, so they're taking off. But none of us did that. And it was the end of the 5th century, which was the death of Socrates in 399, of course, when he's convicted. And he would start with the, talking about how Athens existed to produce someone like Socrates, and yet it was Athens that killed Socrates, and in killing Socrates, essentially, killed itself, et cetera, et cetera. And he went on to the historical and sort of cultural justifications of it. Then he would open up. He opened up the Phaedo, the dialogue that describes his last days, and he would read the last half of the class or so would be him reading the death of Socrates. And at the same moment every time, he'd drink the hemlock, and everyone would pause, and then he would feel his legs, Socrates would feel his legs going under, and he would be talking, and Socrates would be talking to his disciples, and they would pull out a handkerchief and dab his eyes. And then, it gradually, all the Socratic systems are sort of shutting down, and he dabs himself again, and then finally he says, and remember his last words, remember I owe a cock to Asclepius. And so, off would come the glasses, and he would dab, and voice would break, and he'd be cracking, and so ended the noblest life of Western civilization, or something like that. And then what really killed you was, he always ended exactly on the buzzer. The bell within instantly rang, and he just brought the house down. I mean, you applauded, you stand. I mean, it was just, but you applauded his conviction and his love of it. There's I know now as a classicist, there was a lot about what he said that was bogus and not Quran, but you had to applaud how much it meant to him, and that's what we were all after. So it was a wonderful experience to be in his classes, and he would give in his he had a course in comparative literature, which was just Greek and Latin in translation, classics in translation, which were just beautifully polished lectures and ranging on lots of different aspects of classical literature. But then your paper in there was the influence of classics on anybody you wanted. Anybody you were interested in. So it could be the influence of the classics on Milton, the influence of the classics on Freud, the influence of the classics on James Joyce, the influence of the classics on Karl Marx. You know, anybody you were studying, because he knew he got people, you know, various different majors. And he'd grade them all. I mean, he, and the way he was able to do that was by, again, bringing certain expectations. Do you talk about it, the person's education? Do you cite his reading? Do you mention where he cites these authors in his book? And do you, you know, have a decent, I mean, he was just sort of looking for that. It's not that he had a huge knowledge of all these people, but nonetheless, he could intelligently grade all those papers and say something meaningful about it. And, you know, it just made him, it made it very admirable. And the lectures were also full of moral, sort of moral instruction, behavioral instruction, you know? And he was describing one time a modes of humor, because as we were doing this, he had, was going along. And I remember saying in classes, bodily noises seldom divert me. You know, and that was a period where bodily noises diverted all of us. We thought there was nothing funnier in this world. And he just, you know, sort of said that. And boy, we are not amused, you know? And nobody, we all, you know, we all took that to heart. Suddenly, they, you know, wasn't that funny anymore, you know? We talked about it. So, yeah, he was a wonderful person. And and I, you know, I just, I think he was one of those old-time educators who got into the profession to have an effect on people's lives. And it is almost impossible for educators now to do so. It's impossible to challenge students on their sort of deepest convictions, largely because many of them don't have them. And if you do challenge them, they sort of recur to, you know, talk about private property. It's none of our business, you know, get on with it. And you're harassing me because of my political, religious, whatever views. And so I wonder, I don't know if there could be a Dr. Laban these days. You know, that kind of thing.
Did he influence your choice of careers, or did you already know what you want to do?
He influenced me to be a professor. I just thought, I mean, that was the noblest guy I'd ever seen. And I said, that this is a decent model. My father was a physician, and I thought he was a terrific role model. But they had me tested, and I couldn't, I didn't have the aptitude for the medical career because they determined early on that I used to get nauseous at the sight of money. So I was not suited. Also, I couldn't do chemistry and math, so I was hopeless as a doctor. But the second, but you know, I thought if I could, you know, if you could be like Laban, it wouldn't be bad. It wouldn't be a bad life. And he sort of convinced me that there was inherent value in this life. And I did it. He was strictly an amateur of the classics. But he brought the classics into what I took. I mean, I took his sociology courses. I took his religion and society courses. And he, I remember he shocked us once because he was talking about a tribe in New, well, there was the Latin word for sort of character is the plural of a singular word, mores. And, you know, you hear about the mores of this guy. And he made a point of, but he knew it was a plural word, but it was, it had a singular meaning. And so I remember one day he said, the Maori, and he's talking about applying this to a tribe in New Guinea, and he said, the Maori's mores is something, something, but he said, the Maori's mores is. And, you know, one day he said, and so the hoi polloi would say, because he, you know, knew hoi was the definite article and stuff like this, he always, if you were paying attention and you wanted to pay attention, if you paid attention, there was a lot, you know, you could get a lot out of him. But he was basically a, he was basically an amateur of the classical world. And but I did that. Also, I mean, he was one of the few faculty members who produced two really exceptional books. I mean, really, really first-rate books. One on the Haitian people, which had been his sort of, I don't know if it was how he got interested in it, but Very, really a good book that he did at Yale. And then the Scotch-Irish, which, I mean, I think everybody who lives in Virginia ought to read the Scotch-Irish. I mean, it's, you know, the history of sort of the indigenous peoples over here. So he had that terrific scholarly background that a lot of people didn't have, too. Like Lee, I think he was bold and audacious also, where he didn't have to be. As dean, he could have taken a defensive strategy and just sort of just operated on a problem-solving basis. But he came and tried to radically change the school. I mean, he tried to do away with intercollegiate athletics and the grading system. And he even wanted students to wear uniforms. This is curious enough what Tom Wolfe remembers about Leyburn, that he wanted everybody to wear uniforms and so forth. So I think he was, you know, some people might say aggressive, maybe proactive on this way, but. He really did try to make changes. He was ultimately stymied, from doing it. But he really did that. So I think this has only just occurred to me this afternoon, but I think you could really make a lot of sort of parallels between Leyburn and Lee if you wanted to.
But anyway. Was he still dean when you were here?
No, he wasn't. No, I came in 63, and I think he left. He didn't last long as dean, as I recall.
That's what I thought.
And, he went out in the 50s, early 50s, I think. But he stayed, and I think he could have. He had family connections here, but he could have gone on. It seems to me he would have. Could have gone on other places. Yeah.
Well, Rob was right. You do wax poetic about Leyburn. That was a magnificent performance.
No. Sorry. Of course, the other great, great influence I hope will be treated very carefully is my coach, Joe Lyles, who contributed greatly to the tone of the place, and also to the legend of the place, almost as much as Leyburn did in my era.
I don't even know this name, Joe.
Well, Joe Lyles played two professional sports. I think he was a pitcher for the Browns, St. Louis Browns, Major League Baseball, and he played basketball in that golden era of the 50s, early 50s, maybe late 40s, I can't remember, but he was injured in both sports, but he did play. And when I came, he was he coached varsity soccer, JV basketball, and varsity baseball. And in addition, he refereed, and he ran PE, and he played handball without gloves, but single-handedly made handball the most popular sport on campus. I mean, everybody played handball when he was there, but not everybody could play without gloves. As a result, he has trouble turning doorknobs and things now. But and you'd always see him, and his hands would always be sort of vaguely purple, you know, from all the hematoma from playing. But I loved him enormously. I played soccer for 4 years and baseball for two, maybe one. I remember we came up, we were playing Miami of Ohio in baseball. And Joe, for his own reasons, that I still do not understand, used to call me Walt. He knew my name very well. He would write Ward on things, but he called me Walt. And he said, Walt, do you see that pitcher out there from Miami, Ohio? And I said, yeah. He said, he's going to be good. He's going to be really good. And he said, you'll be glad to know you played against him someday. And I said, well, who is it? And it was Mike Schmidt, all-star third baseman of the Phillies, greatest third baseman that ever lived. But I think he was, as I recall, he was pitching that day. And But my fondest memories were playing soccer with him. And I thought of it this morning because Norm Lord got us all lined up during our little walk this morning at 6:45. Norm said something that Joe Lyles had said to us the first day on the soccer. He lined us all up. And he said, "Now count off by ones." We sort of looked at him. I remember I looked at Joe and he said, "Count off by ones." And we all went, "One, one, 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 one," down the line. And he got mad and we all had to run laps after that. But Joe said things that were tremendously profound of a Yogi Berra quality. I mean, and the truth, there are a lot of bogus Lylesisms going around, but there are a lot of there are a lot of truants. And the way you tell it, they have their own distinct quality. We went up to play the NCAA championship in soccer in 65, I think it was November 65. We left with the university cars and we had no gas. And it was Sunday night, rainy Sunday night. And we went out and not only did we have to find the a gas station Sunday night, but we had to find one with the university credit card, which was something like Spud gas or something appalling. So anyway, it turned out to be a guy's house. And here we came in at two, I think it was two cars, two station wagons, maybe three. This guy's house, it was rainy, and he comes out, and he got this slick line, you know, we honked the horn, and he comes out, and I roll down the window, I was driving, and Joe was in the passenger seat, and the guy says, "Fill it up." And I said, "Well, of course." And Joe said, "No, no, no, don't fill it up, we want 14 and 3/4 gallons in the tank." And the guy, you know, looked at him, okay, and goes back, and I said, "Coach, why 14 and 3/4 gallons? Just tell him to fill it up." He said, "Oh, we can't fill up the tank, Walt. There's still some gas left in it." And I thought about this for a while and took it back to Harry when we got back. And then the next morning, we were driving, and the most famous Lylesism of all, I think, I was driving, and we were coming up, and Joe had the map. We were going up, and I said, "Coach, the road forks up ahead here." And he says, "I know." I said, "Well, you got the map. What do I do?" And he said, "Walt, you see that fork in the road?" I said, "I do." He said, "Take it." And I just turned, and somehow we got up to Medford. Well, so I took these back to Harry Pemberton, and I said, "Harry, this guy's nuts." Saying these things. And Harry found deep meaning. He found most of the essence of Western philosophy in the kinds of things Joe was saying. This was the existential choice. This is pure Camus, pure Sartre. You are going down the path of life and the road forks and nobody tells you what to do. You take it. You go your way and that's it. And you can never purge yourself completely of experience, you can never fill up the tank because there's always a little bit of, you left in it and all this kind of stuff. It was wonderful. I can't remember all of them, but I remember an absolutely extraordinary day, which will probably be of no value to you, but an extraordinary thing. I was, 2 days, I was in the student union. I was having a milkshake or something. And my Greek teacher, Mario Pelicharo, came in. And Mario, I think, was always too busy doing 100 other things ever to finish his dissertation, which he never did. But he taught us Greek. And two of us went on to become classics professors, published, and, we did our thing. But he had a unique way of teaching Greek. But he was always interested in all these other things. So Mario comes in. I said, "Mario, what are you up to?" And he said, "Oh, I'm busy. I got so much to do, I can't tell you." He said, I'm going to this opera over in Lynchburg. I got to write a review of that for the paper. I'm working on this book. I'm working my way through Dante with some people here because we got to do it. I'm trying to write a commentary on this. Meanwhile, I got this article. I got to go. And Washington's calling. They want to, I've got to do all this. I said, Mario, I don't understand. Why do you work so hard? Why do all this stuff? You know, this is supposed to be a calm, reflective life. Why are you working so hard? He said, I'll tell you something, Ward. You got to keep working. You got to keep rolling the rock up the hill. Keep rolling the rock up the hill. Because if you don't, all you got is the wisdom of Salinas, which is that it was better. Man was never born. So keep rolling the rock up the hill. Wow, okay. I mean, that was inspired. The next day, I swear to you, the next day, I'm back in the student union, which is nothing unusual in itself. Joe Lyles comes in. And I said, Joe, what are you doing? What's up? He said, well, I just finished playing a tennis tournament. I had two PE classes this morning. We've got baseball practice starting in the gym this afternoon. Then I got to play a handball tournament. Then I'm refereeing a basketball game over in Stanton tonight. And then in the morning, I got to get ready for this. I said, Joe, you're the second guy I've talked to in 2 days. It's working like a maniac. Why do you work so hard? Why do you do this? Why run yourself ragged this way? He said, Walt, you got to keep supplying oxygen to the blood. You've got to put oxygen to the blood. Otherwise, all you've got is lactic acid. I swear that happened. And I just, it was just magic, you know? And Joe's right there. And I worry about lactic acid a lot more than I worry about the wisdom of Salinas, you know? So that was a wonderful experience. And typical about how there was wisdom everywhere on this campus. Everybody. Bob Murphy had wisdom for you. Everybody. Everybody had something to teach you.
This is Murph?
Murph, the campus cop, yeah.
Tell me about Murph.
Murph was magical because he had just a sixth sense about where trouble was going to be. At a fraternity, you'd have problems. All of a sudden, you'd say, okay, the parking lot, let's go. And you go out to the parking lot, and all of a sudden, Murph would just sort of show up. Said, no, not here, And problems with townies sometimes. You'd square off against townies in somewhere, where you shouldn't be or they shouldn't be, either one. And then Murph was suddenly there. This presence, and he was like a mafia enforcer, in that he was kind of a para policeman, paramilitary, He wasn't really the police, but if you had any problems, he was just magically there, like this sort of fairy godfather, and he always forestalled any kind of violence or trouble, because no one dared, challenge Murph. I mean, it was out of the question. I mean, grown men. I knew there were some really, there were people who prided themselves on campus being tough, and people who would. I knew one maniac who used to go over to UVA and just challenge whole fraternity houses to fight, and he wouldn't. Touch Murph. He wasn't going to have a problem with Murph. But then, if you did get into trouble, if you broke a window downtown or got caught for drunk driving or something like that, Murph got you out. I mean, today you'd go to jail and you'd lose your license and you'd be in trouble. But Murph just got you. He just said these are W&L boys, and I'll take care of it from here. And then if Murph told you not to do it again, then you just didn't do it again. That's all.
You turn the tape over.
Okay.